Welcome to Near Death Experience Podcast. I'm Chaz Hathaway. Our website is neardeathexperiencepodcast.org if you would like to see the show notes and so forth. Now, these near-death experiences that I'm sharing, I want to emphasize that I consider this not as a religious discussion or indoctrination of some kind, but rather as a study. It is simply a way of looking at the experiences people have and basically kind of gathering data and trying to figure out what we can learn about the other side from the experiences of other people. And I will admit, there are some experiences that I read that I kind of have to stop and think, you know what, this sounds like a science fiction author just having a little fun with their practice, their writing practice as a writing exercise or something. And so when I come across those, I don't share them on the podcast, obviously. This one that I'm going to share today doesn't seem to be that way. I really genuinely think this is sincere. There are a couple of aspects and I'm like, well, you know, I'm not sure what to make of that, but for the sake of study, I'm going to share it. And I should say also that most of it sounds very credible and it sounds very much like what you might expect. But there's a couple aspects that I'm just kind of like, huh? You know, so we'll go ahead and share this. This is from NDERF.org. That's the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation website. And this is the experience of Christiane, or Christiane, however that's pronounced. At 4 a.m. in the morning, in a sleepy town in Canada, a vision of my grandfather, who I call Papa, awoke me from a sound sleep. Papa was calling my name across time and space. Papa was safe in the hospital. I awoke as usual, got up, dressed, and went downstairs to eat breakfast. In the middle of my breakfast, my mother entered the dining room, speaking with a hysterical tone in her voice. "Change your clothes. We need to go to the hospital. Papa fell out of bed and broke his hip." In the car, my mother and I were silent. She drove faster than ever before. Papa needed hip surgery. After many hours of surgery, Papa was brought back to his hospital bed. I stayed with him, and I was there with him when he died. He looked straight into my eyes and called out a name I had never heard before. That name was Tilly. It was the name of my deceased grandmother, whom I had never known. Papa was 16 days away from his 89th birthday, and I would turn 14 23 days later. I was fascinated with Papa's eyes seeing something I could not see, but I did see or hear Papa calling out to me. Could death be such an extraordinary event that we have treated it with ignorance and fear? Now I'm going to pause for a second. I think this is what you might refer to, what we might refer to as a shared death experience. There may be other terms that apply here, but a shared death experience is something of somebody is dying and you get to take part in something of that experience, the spiritual or beyond the veil aspect, some beyond the veil aspect of the experience. In this case, she sees or hears, well, she says a vision, so probably see and hear, her grandfather, who was on the brink of death, and then also being present as he is seeing her grandmother, his wife. And so I think there's enough there that you could call that a shared death experience. But this is not where the account ends. Okay, continuing on. 2 years later, my mother died. Funerals were such sad and maudlin events to me. I would miss mother and my papa, but no one had any answers for me. And the world of adults, and remember, she's just turning 14, I believe. She just turned 14. No. This would be 15 at this point, because it's 2 years later. And the world of adults shunned my questions. I wasn't asking any questions anyone was willing to answer. And I was even more irritated when I discovered we'd be staying safe within the parameters of the event. Fled death by turning it over to the clergy, who all, as it turned out, had no idea what to tell me and would simply ignore my questions. No one dared allude to me that the psychic realm was bordering on Satanism. I was usually helping them more with insights or precognition than they helped me. At the age of 4 and a half, my mother and I were visiting friends. So obviously we're jumping back at this point. At age 4 and a half, my mother and I were visiting friends. I went outside in their lovely backyard and fell into their fish pond. Suddenly, I was lifted out of the pond, and as I looked up, I saw this blinding beam of light, and there was a man with blue eyes in a suit and white and snow-white hair. I was dripping wet. I had a conversation with this man, who I called Norman, and I always called our higher being Norman. Norman seemed to be an angel. Norman also told me I had a special mission. Matters at hand were to go back inside the house, present myself to the owners. As I stood beside Fred Webster, who owned the local newspaper, it was obvious as the nose on my face, I fell into the fish pond. "I fell into the fish pond, Fred," said I as I stood behind him, or beside him at the dining table, dripping wet. "How did you get out of the fish pond? That fish pond is 5 feet deep." "An angel came and rescued me, Fred." With that remark, Fred excused himself from the table, went to his den, picked up the phone, and said to his friend, "I don't care if it is Sunday. I need someone to come over and fill my fish pond. One miracle is all I can take with that pond." Indeed, the pond was filled in. I was dried off, and no more was said. My next event was in Lake Ontario. I was swimming at what was an outing for a 7th birthday party with cousins, and suddenly I was being swept out deeper. My life, short as it was, but erratic as it had been with divorced parents, flashed before my eyes. The next thing I knew, I was not on Earth, but flying around the amusement park, which was amusing, and then over the Earth towards the U.S. As I seemed to re-enter my body, I was being given artificial respiration and came to as if nothing had happened. I told a cousin about my experience. She told my aunt, and I never talked about that again. Years lapsed between the drowning event and my next near-death experience. I was now almost 30, and I was getting a root canal. Today, this was a common procedure, but in 1973, it was fairly new. Upon returning from the dentist, I spoke to neighbors, but was feeling woozy. So I went inside my townhouse, where I promptly collapsed. I was dying. My neighbor came over and apparently called an ambulance. I was out of my body, unconcerned about following that body, feeling a freedom of spirit that was just incredible. I flew from Lansing, Michigan, to New York, then Chicago, in record time. It was as if I thought about a place on Earth. I could be there instantly, without taking trains, boats, or planes. How long I was out of my body like this, I do not know. Suddenly, it was as if something alerted me, in my whimsical mood of flight, that I was being called back to my body. I could see that this body in the hospital room, or I could see this body in the hospital room as I flew in. It looked like a corpse. "She has a heartbeat. I guess we'll see if she stays stable, and then we'll see how she is, and then she can be released." The voice of a male doctor I had never seen before was saying. Now I was back in my body in a hospital setting, lying on a gurney, wondering what had happened. Prior to this experience, I had dreadful fear of dying. That fear included dying too young. Just dying because I was too perplexed and too upset with the current way that dying was being dealt with in life. I'd never heard of near-death experiences. It just didn't seem to be an appropriate term for the actual event I call the dying phenomenon. On July 6, 1976, I had left East Lansing, Michigan, and was living in San Francisco, California. I died on the street. I hovered over my body, had no tunnel of light, no reuniting with relatives, just a 105-degree fever and no heartbeat. I was on the corner of Valencia and Market Streets. Flipping backwards down, I went. I hovered over my body and then came back to life. I was taken to San Francisco General Hospital, having died again en route, and was referred to as the body. As the dead body, there were stirrings. I pulled off the sheets, got off the gurney in this extremely cold room. I was still wearing my Givenchy shoes with a lot of money tucked in them. I had been leaving home to get an antibiotic. I was walking around in the hallway when a nurse came up to me and thought I needed my temperature taken. She couldn't believe that I was walking around if my temperature was indeed 105. So she got one of those electric thermometers. I decided to leave, get a cab, and go to Presbyterian Hospital. Now transported to Presbyterian Hospital, I wanted my own doctor. I collapsed again. I recall being in the room, being given a shot in my heart, and the next thing I knew, I was back in the new wing at San Francisco General, hearing that I was going to be given a spinal tap without my consent. I came to a delirious sort of way. I was alone in the new wing, but I could hear music, Calliope music. I could see Burgess Meredith playing this huge Calliope. I drifted off again, only to awaken again and again, seeing Burgess Meredith playing the same Calliope, but without a couple occupying the bed at the end of the ward who had been making love on duty. I awoke screaming with a headache and was quickly pushed down by one very strong, bossy nurse. This was the worst headache I had ever had. I used to get migraine headaches as a kid, then get very psychic, eat grapefruit, and the headache would go away. I had lost control of my bike at age 8, ran smack into the side of a truck, emerging unscathed. Not quite as dramatic an emergency as totaling my yellow Vega wagon was in East Lansing, Michigan. I'm going to pause for a second. This is a little bit hard to follow simply because they're jumping around so much. Suddenly we're age 4, now we're age 30, now we're age 8, now we're age, you know. But there is certainly something of a whimsical aspect to this narrative, and the punctuation is such that I kind of have to guess at where some, you know, ideas start and stop. I'm kind of winging it here, but I'm catching this theme of this person is finding it all kind of funny. And so they're jumping around in this, in all the medical stuff, and yet having these incredible spiritual experiences, leaving the body and then going back in and so forth. And anyway, okay. The fever subsided. I did not have spinal meningitis. I was released, but the following month I had a fever again. The fever subsided. I began to have fevers for 12 months out of 14 months, missing February and August. My fevers would peak to 103. I'd call a cab, get a room at UCSC, be observed, perplex every physician on staff. I would get a rash starting on my face. The whites of my eyes would get red, and I would dehydrate. Somewhere between July 6, 1976 ordeal and 1978, I was given a medication with alcohol in it for asthma. I was an alcoholic. I took a sauna, could feel something dreadful happening. My blood pressure was sky high. I got to Presbyterian Hospital. I began to hear voices, felt really weird, and the next thing I knew, I was above me, watching docs give me another shot to the heart. I was detoxed from the asthma meds with the usual anti-seizure meds. Released, but something happened. I have released, but something happened. I may have had another fever spell, but this one would be so vastly different from any other fever spell and from any of the near-death experiences I have ever had. I had flown through a tunnel. I had seen a light before. I had entered into a field of great beauty, had seen a field, or had seen and felt a peace of mind, body and spirit not ever felt before. I was in UCSC in a room with a view. I was in a sort of coma and had died again. I looked up. A doctor was drawing my blood slowly, and this blood was going into a very large container. The blood was the color of rust. He kept drawing blood. I left my body quickly, not because I fainted at the sight of blood. As I watched the doctor, I felt at peace. When I got back into my body and was out of the apparent danger zone I'd been in on the earth plane, my heart's erratic beats from arrhythmia had hospital employees humming. I was not ever going to be the same person. Little did I know, I was going to be called another name. I was alert, unable to speak. I thought the moaning I was making made perfect sense. No one person could understand me. I went to write and hold this pen in my right hand and stared at it blankly, and then watched as it dropped to the floor where it made a ping sound. I tried to move my neck. I seemed paralyzed. I didn't know where I was or who I was. I was set to get up and dance around with joy Instead, I really knew that the star of the Life of Riley TV show meant what he said. What a revolting development this is. He wasn't kidding. Coming back to life was not easy. Learning to walk, talk, read, and write was quite a chore. It was also quite an ordeal. Those right-handed writing lessons were awful. Well, one of the four tasks was better than none at all, but it just wasn't my speed. I was a quick study and this just wasn't up to my speed. Progress was slow, methodical, and sometimes miserable. My mind was racing and nothing else could keep up or cooperate or perform properly. I was a ravenous, hungry relearner. Slowly things began to return, not exactly to normal, but I didn't know there was a normal. I had humor, lots of it. In fact, it was my best suit. In fact, maybe it's been my only suit since I returned. My humor seems to irritate everyone. I learned in my journey that you must laugh. Only the most highly intelligent of the people species are endowed with humor. They all are also the most highly evolved. I lost everything. But it turned out it was others who were so upset and full of anger. These others were also judgmental, rigid, greedy, and about as unchristian as charging wild rhinos. What a wonderful welcome back to planet Earth. I was sent to see a psychiatrist, a woman doctor in San Francisco. This call was my emergency call. I suggested she answer her phone, exclaiming it was an emergency, adding, I think it would be over if, think it over if you want to see me. I know you don't, and I'm not certain I want to work with you. It was no trick. It worked. She realized I had something from the time I was a child. I thought everyone had these abilities, seeing visions, extraordinary hearing, and knowing, all understanding. Instead, I learned that I was the oddball. I'm still skeptical of the scientific ones who cannot believe if they cannot prove something exists on the material plane. Humor is the greatest gift. The ability to laugh is the ability to forgive and live in a better world. I can't stand offices. They're humorless, devoid of sound. No one's sitting waiting for a doctor speaks to anyone else. Whose rule is that? Concentrate on the sick self now. Loretta scheduled no one in her office waiting room but me. I'd say, I know you have more patients, Loretta. Afraid I'll heal them? One day I actually got her to laugh. How? I said, you will be leaving here shortly. She claimed she'd never leave San Francisco. Goodbye, Loretta. I didn't find work. I didn't solve my problems. I was alone in this cold and stable city, in this cold as stone city, with 40-degree weather, getting locked on buses, have to use my booted feet to boot doors open, and get to know more cable car drivers than bus drivers. I survived. How? I had little money, no work, and met this woman who was about to retire from real estate. I became her arms, legs, and driver. She put a roof over my head. To this day, my dad still talks about the number of addresses I had and doesn't get it. I didn't know about Social Security, taxes, unemployment benefits, and workman's compensation. One time, as I was in sales demonstrating products, I was to do a fraction. "What's a fraction?" I asked. The man I asked said, "Gems, did you just land on this planet, girly, or what?" "Of course," I said, "yeah," to having just landed on the planet. I almost had an opportunity to take a scriptwriting course in L.A. to work on the Mork and Mindy show. I was in the hospital. I did talk to Robin Williams, paid my money for the class, $100, never took it, but I guess the show was successful without me. I lost the $100. Frightening as any near-death experience is, it seems the experience is to provide an impetus for spiritual transformation. It was not until my fifth near-death experience with the incredible experience with the butterfly that the full implication of near-death experiences was clear to me. Upon my arrival at this crystal-powered city, I call Paralandria the city of celestial light, where I was introduced to mindspeak. Mindspeak is a communication without using words. It is an etheric passing of information through energy from one being to another, as if by osmosis. One has an instant understanding and sense of ideas, concepts, and thoughts of any other being. Upon returning to planet Earth, I realized that a science fiction writer, C.S. Lewis, had referred to Paralandria in one of his works, so I changed the name to Pseudolandria. Pseudolandria was like a land of enchantment, but not an amusement park. It was gloriously colored and auroraed in lively pastel hues. It was after my initial introduction to Czar that I was both sent and led down a non-hallway where there were rooms with light and illuminating from within the room only. The first room was the room of forgiveness. In here, one had to cast off all aspersions? I think it's supposed to say aspirations, but it says aspersions. Done to the self or done to others by the self. Maybe aspersions is a word. I don't know. Before one could leave there, they were required to feel self-love, be cleansed, healed, and let go of all concepts pertaining to earthly tenants' sins. Once this in this room, one stayed until all the necessary vibrational tune-ups to the soul were accomplished. Since there was no way to measure the concept of time by earthly standards, the events happen as if one is getting dry cleaning or a vibrational air bath. One does not actually walk into these rooms. One is led as if one is floating in space, and yet one seems so solid in space. One simply moves from room to room when it is deemed appropriate to move on. The concept of left brain dominance in our Earth society came out of this experience. The right brain concept becomes dominant upon returning to the Earth. Evidently, right brain use has become more commonly associated with the drawing on the right side of the brain concept. I assure you, the right brain concept is the most important aspect of the near-death experience. It was here in the realm where I was shown how schools, banks, governments, and most systems are based on left-brain concepts. It is also the principle in which the material sciences are entrenched. These left-brain concepts have a strong foothold in the material world. Those of the material world are the Scrooges, who are rigid, unloving, uncaring, unkind, and seem to operate at robotic or automation levels in life. There is a room to show future events. After entering and being excited from this chamber room, when one returns to this Earth planet, one usually connects with others who have had near-death experiences, or others who are naturally tuned into the vibrational frequency levels of similar humans. There's not a sense that this is just one room, one concept, and others are present in these rooms, but they are not noticed by perfumes, apparel, or other ego-centered characteristics or traits. One's energy level is as subtle as a whisper, as gentle as a sigh, and as quiet as a flower. I had always had numbers happen in threes, for instance, three ones or so on happened to me without problems. That was until I lived on a street with addresses of three fives. This was my fifth NDE, and prior to this, I had zeroed out on computers, lost everything. I mean everything, my house, car, and child, and almost lost myself. I have not seen my child in 25 years. Personally, I believe it took more than the room of forgiveness to tune me up to the high level of consciousness. Room after room provided an area of cleansing for the soul. It was akin to a university of knowledge concept. It was a job or work while there. It was not just a duty, it was more like a desire to become a better person in every way was the way it was, as opposed to the way things were. As my soul lifted out of my body, I felt these incredible wings envelop me. It was as if I was being taken in my own private rocket into space at incredible speed. I had no time to think about looking back to Earth and saying goodbye. I could hear the soft voice of what seemed like a female, assuring me I would be back. Suddenly the wings opened, and I was deposited on a path. The butterfly vanished. Before me was the crystal city with its pale pastel colors, but of very bright shimmering hues of pinks, blues, yellows, purple, white, and green. I was moving forward as if I was being pulled or magnetized toward a destination. There were no doors, but I seemed to have arrived. I looked around. I saw a male figure that seemed faceless but in charge. His name was Zar. I was called Quasar. I was given no actual papers, but I was to take these invisible papers, liquid crystal sheets, to a room. There were rooms. I went from one to another, floating. I seemed to have a body that was bodiless, massless, shape and form, but no weight. I could see that I had a typical body, but it just didn't feel like my Earth body. I was aware of the fact I was going to return to Earth. I made the circle of chambers, which I was informed through MindSpeak for programming and a tune-up vibrationally. I could hear faint music that was soft and almost unnoticeable. It was faint to the ears. It seemed to have a resonance that was tuning me up. I saw files, chambers, and doors that were not doors. I was given a tour in the invisible limo. Another faceless person sat, and we toured the city. I called it Paralandria. I later called it Pseudolandria. There was no time, but there was a feeling of being able to absorb time as if it was a stellar beam of its own frequency. I was relaxed, not afraid. I wanted very much to see my papa, but he was not around. I heard a voice from the void speaking to my mind. She is ready for return or takeoff, is how I translated it. Okay, so that's the end of that account. Boy, what to say about this one. First off, I heard a program recently. It was talking about, it was a couple of podcasters talking, and they were talking about how they never release a show that if you know, that if somebody was getting on the show for the first time and first experiencing it, would you want this to be a show that they encounter as the first one they ever encounter, or possibly the only one? And if the answer is no, then it's probably not one worth releasing. You probably shouldn't use that show. Now, I'm tempted to think that way with this because in style, it's very scattered, you know, so it's kind of hard to follow the timeline here, which, you know, it's not a big deal. That's fine. But just how, I mean, so let me just put it this way. If this is your first time listening to the show, don't judge the show by this show. Okay. Not because it's a bad experience or it's a bad example or something. It's just, it's going to take some picking apart a little bit. And we've talked about detail levels of near-death experiences, and I'm finding it increasingly frustrating to try to communicate exactly how to describe this, because some people give really good detail, like really, some people can give so much detail that it's almost distracting or even gets to the point of boring, and then others give so little detail that it's like, yeah, and so I died on the operating table and then I went to heaven, but when I came back, you know, I'd done a lot of stuff, but when I came back, you know, it hurt a lot or something. You're like, what? You know, tell me about what went on. And they're like, oh, well, it was light and there was cool stuff that happened. And you're like, you're not giving me anything to go on. And then, you know, once you get it out of them, turns out it was this big in-depth experience. Now, not that you want to drive it out of people. There's a difference between somebody holding back information and someone just not being a detail-oriented speaker or explainer or whatever. Well, then it's the explanations that I'm talking about, the detail explanations. And so I've kind of decided to come up with a scale, and we'll put it at 1 to 5. At first I was thinking 1 to 10, but I'm not that precise about things anyway. So we're just going to say a 1 to 5 scale. 1 being, you know, I went to heaven, did some stuff, and then came back. And then 5 being, you know, I, you know, felt this, you know, strange sensation come over me that started out in my abdomen and then tingled up my spine and then went to this, and all this to describe the spirit leaving the body. You know, I mean, it's like so detailed that you kind of get lost in the details. And so, you know, a scale of 1 to 5, and then of course 0 being no detail at all, but we'll say 1 to 5. This person is probably a 2 for all the things they've experienced, okay? So you hear these things, you're like, wait, what? What's the Crystal City, what? You know, and you get lost in these details, or in this lack of details. And yet this person obviously had an incredibly profound experience, numerous of them. In fact, it kind of became a thing throughout their life. And there's several things to be said about this. So first off, I'm going to say this person is a number 2 detailer. They're giving just enough detail to kind of dangle, you know, carrots of ideas that you're like, wait, what? You know, so they're just not giving a lot of detail. But one of the things that becomes apparent very quickly is that, I don't know if it's this 4-year-old account of them falling in the water or the 4-year-old experience, or if it's something that happened even before that, but this person has clearly had a severe case of after effects from their initial experience, okay? A severe case. And I hate to use the word case because it sounds like a disease or a problem, when it can actually be, I mean, they're gifts. They're clearly gifts, but they're also a curse for many people. And you can kind of see that play out in this person's experience. So kind of trying to back away, look at this non-detailed account of a bunch of different experiences and kind of get a broad view of this. What I'm seeing is that this individual, as a very, very young child, had their first experience, had an angel rescue them from drowning. We'll just consider that to be their first experience because that's the first that she apparently knows of. Okay. So this experience of nearly drowning, or possibly drowning, you know, and being rescued by an angel, sets off a lifetime of after effects that include knowing things, that include hearing voices, seeing spirits, being more susceptible to near-death experiences, such that even sometimes being in a, you know, in the right set of circumstances where they're not near death, they slip into a near-death experience. Now, as an unfortunate result, and this is something that shows a brokenness to our system as a society, we are not equipped yet. We're working on it, but we're not equipped yet to deal with somebody with these kind of gifts, these kind of abilities, and the kind of thinking that a person tends to take on after having a near-death experience. They have a very, let's use the term, they use a very right brain mindset. Things like jobs, things like money really don't matter much. They're just not a big deal to them. And so it leads to very difficult hardships in the life. And you know, from what I gather, I mean, they went through some alcoholism. I don't know about drugs. That wasn't very clearly stated, but some homelessness, if I'm not mistaken. And their experience was with doctors was a very untrusting experience. You know, they're like, "What are you doing? You know, get out of me. You get away from me. I'm leaving now," and kind of things. And also a very humorous person, very humorous. In fact, it wasn't until, I mean, I had read this, but it wasn't until I was reading it out loud about a third of the way through, I realized they're very tongue-in-cheek in just about everything that they're saying, that she is saying. It takes a while to figure out that it's a girl here until the experience. It says, the doctor's quote, "She has a heartbeat. I guess we'll see if she stays stable," and so forth. So this is a girl that's talking. But she's a very humorous individual, and not very detailed, but humor-oriented. And so things are said so flippantly that it's kind of hard to follow the story a little bit. And plus, jumping around from age, you know, I think what started out age 13, then going to 4, and then going to 8. No, sorry. I'm going to 30, and then going to 8, and then jumping all over the lifetime. A 7th birthday party, age 30, you know, we're just jumping all over the place. And so it's a little bit hard to follow the, and then she just starts using dates after that, and I'd have to create a little time table to, in order to really decode this well. But the point is, okay, that I think this is a real experience, and for a number of reasons. One, the person is not shy about sharing, and yet doesn't share a lot of detail. You know, there's reason to think that if somebody is trying to gain a following or get attention and so forth, they're going to use a little bit of flowery language or something that reflects on them some kind of extra knowing or so and so forth. But this person, this lady, seems to take it as it was a bit of a curse because she didn't get anybody. You know, I mean, nobody would get her. And so she got people well because she could read them in some way. And yet she couldn't relate to them in a lot of ways because of their mindsets that were so different than hers. And it was like this estrangement thing. And I'm inclined to believe her experiences. And yet she goes into this almost science fiction-y thing with the different names of paralandria and pseudolandria that she calls it because it's halfway between paralandria and whatever. The fact that she decides to change the name of it makes me think that this was just a name she came up with that seemed to fit and so forth. And, you know, this reflects well on that concept of there's just not words for this stuff. There's just not words. And for somebody who's so undetail-oriented, there's even fewer words to go with. So what you're looking at is this person that had these incredible experiences. If she were to get really good with language and sharing more detail in a very followable manner, she could write an incredible book that could totally, you know, open up more of this study of near-death experiences, because clearly she talks about various rooms and their roles and so forth, and yet it's said in such a quick, flippant way that it's like, wait a minute, you're in a room of healing now, you're in a room of forgiveness, and now you're in a room of, you know, and you kind of lose the flow in the lack of detail, and yet you'll get these mentions of the crystal city and the butterfly, and you're like, wait, what butterfly? What, you're on the wings of a butterfly, or wait a minute, what, you know? And so we kind of get lost in it. But I think it's worth noting that these kind of experiences, I think they're legit. I think they're real, and they fit. And the difficulty that people have with sharing such experiences is that they're not trained in words. They're not trained in the spiritual history of religions and have all these pristine words to put in to say, this is what happened, this was my vision, this was my experience, whatever. And they're just like, okay, and this happened. And they're kind of like, you know what, take it or leave it, because I don't get you guys anyway. I don't understand why you think the way you do, why you see things the way you do. So, you know, here it is. And that's kind of what I'm getting out of this, all with a very healthy dose of humor, which they come up, they even say that only the highest intelligence beings and species and so forth actually have humor as part of their psyche and so forth. And it's hard to tell whether that was just an observation based on, you know, their own personal experience in life, or whether that was something that she learned in her near-death experiences, or whether she's just saying it as a way of saying, you know, I'm so smart, I'm, you know, I just find funny, you know, things funny, and that only the most intelligent people find things funny, you know, kind of thing. It's hard to tell. Anyway, enough of that. But I do want to say that I think I'll start using that scale of 1 to 5 for detail orientedness, because it kind of helps too in the analysis of the experience. But again, if this is your first time hearing this podcast, please listen to another before judging it. I'm trying to be thorough in my exploration of near-death experiences. And so I hope you'll take this one as an interesting one that gives some interesting little details that we can certainly put on file, if you will, but without considering this to be a typical near-death experience. So before we finish up, our phone number is 970-633-2278. That's 970-NDE-CAST. And you can also reach us at neardeathexperiencepodcast@gmail.com. You can also comment on the website, which is neardeathexperiencepodcast.org. And once again, as always, thank you so much, all of you, for listening.